Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today grew up among family secrets. Edward Wong is the son of Chinese immigrants, and his father rarely spoke about his native land or his years in the People's Liberation Army under Mao. Edward Wong is a diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. In 25 years at the Times, he has reported from various countries, served as a war correspondent in Iraq, and as the Beijing bureau chief. He's been a visiting professor at Princeton and at UC Berkeley. He speaks on global affairs on outlets such as CBS, MSNBC, BBC, PBS, and NPR. When Edward Wong became bureau chief for the New York Times, he investigated his father's mysterious past. His groundbreaking book, At the Edge of Empire, is an essential work for understanding China today. Edward Wong, ni hao.
Ni hao. How are you, Nancy?
I had to throw in a little Mandarin. I just described your book as groundbreaking. Would you agree with that?
Nancy, when I was writing this book, I did want to try something new with this book. I didn't want to just write an account of my time as a journalist in China, which many reporters do when they leave China, and didn't want to write purely a family history either. I wanted to combine those two types of books in order to frame what was going on in current day China through the lens of events that happened in the past, and particularly to my family. And I thought that by having this family narrative set during the Mao era in China, it would draw the reader along on this epic journey across China. And at the same time, would also give readers a sense of how history continues to resonate in China today and how we see echoes of the founding of communist era China in some of the policies and the events that are unfolding in China right now and that are impacting U.S.-China relations.
Well, you mentioned that when you were a student at Berkeley, you say you were pursuing parallel inquiries, one into the history, society, and politics of China through your coursework and conversations with professors, and the other into your family history. And that's what I found. I so appreciated the fact that you wrote your book this way, Edward, because you can read history books and dates and people and what they did, but I found myself reacting emotionally to your book, and that surprised me.
I'm glad to hear that, Nancy, because I think that I wanted to try and do something that I've seen a few other writers do in their narratives that capture national history, which is tell that national history through people that they have been close to,
yes,
or through people that they have learned a lot about. And, you know, it's hard to be closer to anyone than your parents. And I learned a lot about my parents' history starting, as you say, when I was a grad student at Berkeley, but then delved even deeper into it after I came back from China. So starting in 2018, when I moved to Washington to be a diplomatic correspondent here, I began interviewing my parents in depth about their time in China. I sat down with my father in the basement of my childhood home and had many long conversations that I recorded. And I came to see very clearly the arc of his 12 years in China and what that had done to him, what it had done to his hopes and dreams. And I aimed to try and put all that in the book. My mother left China at an earlier age, so she didn't experience communist China as vividly as my father had. And so I decided I needed to tell the story through the journey that my father took when he was in the Chinese army.
My guest is New York Times correspondent Edward Wong, and he's telling us about his book. The title is At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. And you go to New York and you happen to be living in downtown Manhattan when the terrorists bombed the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. So you were there in New York, September 11th, 2001, and so what did you do after that? Did that, I mean, it had to have affected you. In what way?
I mean, obviously, it was a horrific incident. I still remember it vividly. I think many people who are living in New York or Washington that day have strong memories of those events and of the weeks and months afterwards. And probably everyone who lived in downtown Manhattan knew someone who had been deeply affected by what had happened in those attacks. And of course, that started the U.S. on this path of what they called, what U.S. officials called the war on terror. And they sent troops to Afghanistan, they invaded Afghanistan, toppled the Taliban government there, began the hunt for al-Qaeda. And then they also invaded Iraq. And I ended up going to Iraq as a correspondent. I spent 3.5 years there. And by the time I left Iraq, I was pretty burnt out as a reporter in that country. And I also felt disillusioned with American foreign policy. And the reason is because it was clear to me that the war had been started under false pretenses. And I think many Americans had come to see that by then. And also, we were destroying this country in the heart of the Middle East. You know, thousands of civilians were dying and American troops were dying. And there seemed to be no good reason for the U.S. to be doing this. And the American leaders have been misguided in all the choices they made along the way. And so I asked my editors to send me to China, partly because obviously I've been interested in China from early in my adult life, but also because I felt that here in China, there was a new type of country that was coming onto the world stage. And it was a country that seemed to be looking to the future rather than mired in it seemed to be a country that was looking to the future rather than the one that was mired in the past, or one that seemed to be a superpower that was in a stage of weakening and erosion, as the United States seemed to be when I left Iraq.
Well, you tell us in your book how you felt when you just arrived there in Beijing. Would you read from your book about what it was like just to arrive? And you even use the word pessimistic. Would you read us a couple of paragraphs from that section?
Sure. This is in the prologue, Nancy.
Yes.
For someone just arriving, it seemed like China's leaders and its people were working every muscle of the country to build the future. It represented the opposite of the abyss I had seen in Iraq. Years of reporting there on the disintegration of a country had left me pessimistic about the nature of humanity and the wielding of power. Two Iraqi colleagues, Khalid and Faqa, were among the many killed in violence that would ultimately result in the loss of about 300,000 lives. The destruction and carnage have been more shocking because they were the direct consequence of American actions. They have been inflicted by a nation, my nation, that just a decade earlier had been handed a historic opportunity to use its position as an unchallenged superpower to help lead the world into a better place. Instead, American leaders took their country down the path of imperial bloodletting in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. Those in the American political class stayed in denial for years about what they had done. When I stepped off an airplane in the gleaming new Beijing airport terminal on a warm night in April 2008, I thought that if any power represented an alternative vision of the future, surely it was China. Back then, the path of progress its leaders had taken since the catastrophes under Mao and the violent suppression of protests in 1989 seem to signal an embrace of more enlightened ideas.
This is New York Times correspondent Edward Wong reading from his book, At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. Now, the word family is in the title of your book, Edward, and it's moving how you want to go back to where your grandfather was buried. And your grandfather, 63, is pretty young to die. You say your grandfather died in Hong Kong at age 63. So why did you want to find his tomb?
Well, in Chinese tradition, there is this custom where you pay respects to the elders and the ancestors that have come before you. And what people often do, maybe once a year, maybe sometimes a bit more rarely than that, they will go to the ancestor's tomb and perform certain rituals there. They might sweep it. They might bring some food and leave it there. They might bring flowers and leave it there. They might burn incense. And I knew my parents, when I went to Hong Kong in 1997, I knew my parents had not been back to Hong Kong since they had moved to the U.S. Several decades earlier. And so I felt that it was my responsibility in certain ways to perform those rituals at my grandfather's tomb. And my father put me in touch with a cousin of his, a woman named Wen Hearn, and she and her brother took me and another cousin up into the hills of Hong Kong Island, where we walked among other tombstones, many grave sites, and they eventually found my grandfather's tomb. And there I burned incense sticks and bowed to him. And for me, it was a direct connection, a direct line through the generations back to my grandfather, back to the people who preceded him. And it was just me carrying out these Chinese traditions, Chinese customs. And I followed Chinese traditions at certain times when I was growing up, for example, during Lunar New Year, when my family would gather for meals together. So it was something that I was somewhat used to. But at the same time, my father, when I told him I wanted to do this, he told me he was very surprised by it, because he just assumed that immigrant children, ones who are born in the U.S., eventually lose their sense of tradition or their sense of culture, and then they become very assimilated into American culture without maintaining any of the roots in their native culture. But I still had this instinct, and I felt I needed to follow it, and it was a connection to my family. And in a way, the book kind of encapsulates that, because the book is a document about my search for my family roots. I go back to my ancestral village in southern China. I look for places that my father, where my father had served in the Chinese army, to the very farthest reaches of China, in the northwest, in Central Asia, in the northeast, in Manchuria. And so the book in some ways is this document of being among the Chinese American diaspora and then going back and looking for your roots. And at the same time, it's also telling the stories, the national stories of China and how it has changed from the Mao era up until the current era.
Well, and you mentioned too that your parents' courtship was in Hong Kong. So that must have brought back, you must have imagined what it was like when they were young and courting each other in Hong Kong.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go back to Hong Kong with my parents when they went in 1999. They went on a trip with my sister. I was finishing grad school, and they went on this trip where they visited some cities in China and they visited Hong Kong. So when they came back, they told me stories about how they had revisited places from their childhood and from their early adult years. And obviously, Hong Kong is this very almost mythical city, I think, in the imaginations of many people. It's a very unique city, and we often get our first glimpses of Hong Kong through films and through popular media. And that was the case with me once growing up as a child, having watched many movies from Hong Kong in my early years. And so I had these visions of maybe what their early childhood had been like, what their courtship had been like, what their marriage had been like. And then I learned a lot more details of that as I was doing interviews with them for the book, both earlier when they first came back from that trip, and then later when I was really delving into the family secrets, into the family history in the more recent years when I was doing the heavy research and the writing for the book.
Well, you mentioned your parents' courtship in Hong Kong, but people might be wondering, well, is Edward married? Where did he meet his wife? He's traveling all over the place. And I thought it was rather romantic where you met your future wife.
Yeah, I don't know how many people meet their spouses in a war zone, but I met my wife in Baghdad. I was posted there as a New York Times journalist. She was the bureau chief for the Associated Press in Hanoi. She's Vietnamese American, and she wanted to go back to Vietnam to work there. And the AP sent her to Baghdad to do some temporary assignments while the war was going on. And then we met over drinks in Baghdad. And then we kept up this long distance courtship. And
you said it was on the banks of the Tigris River. My gosh, what a historical place. You met on the banks of the Tigris River.
Yeah, one of the ancient rivers.
So then some time goes by and you move to China. And what happens?
Right. China is the first place where we live together and we get married there. And our marriage was important for, you know, obviously for a lot of reasons, but it also brought my parents back to China for the first time since they went on that tour in 1999. It was the first time I'd seen them in China. And so that was important for me. I saw their reactions to contemporary China. I talked with them more about their histories in the country. And I could get a better sense of why they had made the decision to move to America and why my father had decided to flee China in the early 1960s. And even at this stage, when China was booming, they appreciated the advances that China made, but they still felt that there were things holding the country back that wasn't as fully realized in many respects as America was back then in 2009. When I got married. And so I got an interesting perspective on the country from them. And then my daughter was born in 2012 in Beijing, and they came back again. And that was, again, another important moment for my relationship with my parents and for learning more about them. And on that trip, my father decided to go to Guangzhou, the capital of Guangdong province in the south, which is next to Hong Kong, because he had decided to get in touch with some high school classmates from that era, from the late 1940s and 1950, which was when he graduated. And they invited him down and said they would organize a reunion. So I went down to Guangzhou with him. We flew down and I spent several days down there with him. And it was eye-opening hearing him talk to his classmates, hearing them reminisce about their days back in the late 40s. Which was when the Chinese Civil War was going on and the communists were fighting the nationalists for control of China. And also hearing about his classmates' experiences in China in the decades since, under Mao Zedong, under Deng Xiaoping, who was another very important leader in China, and to hear about how they went from the deprivations and the suffering of the Mao era to the boom eras of what we call the reform and opening up period in China, when the economy really boomed, when it became integrated into world commerce, and how some of these classmates have become very wealthy business people based on that. So I really saw this whole arc of the change in China through their eyes, and it was a revelation for me.
My guest is Edward Wong. He is a correspondent for the New York Times, and we're talking about his book, At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is New York Times diplomatic correspondent Edward Wong, and his book is At the Edge of Empire. After you moved to China, you proposed to your future wife, and what was her name?
Penny Tran.
So you have this wedding in Beijing, and your parents come, and here's another time when I just wanted to cry also. What happened at your wedding?
When my parents attended my wedding, then after we did the rituals of marriage, we were walking through this temple compound where we had held the ceremony. And I was walking with my parents, and then my dad embraces me and he starts crying. And it was the only time I've seen my father cry. It was very moving to me. And it felt like it embodied all the emotions that he had felt throughout my childhood. My dad was not someone who easily expressed his emotions. He wasn't someone who talked a lot about his feelings. I think many Asian immigrants who are fathers, many Chinese immigrants who are fathers are that way. And their children often perceive a distance between them and their parents or their fathers. But here, my dad really opened up, embraced me, hugged me, and cried. And it obviously, this moment, this wedding, this marriage felt like a pivotal moment for him. Maybe he felt it was me finally entering adulthood after, almost four decades. But it gave me a window, obviously, into his feelings, his emotions. I think the fact that he was there in China, also in Beijing, which he hadn't stepped foot in for many decades since he was a student there. I think that really had an impact on him also.
Well, now that we're on the subject of families, I was sad to hear what took place when the Chinese laborers would come to this country, and specifically here in California, and these men could not bring their wives or children. And so just imagine these men died alone when they would come here to build railroads. And this is just, it saddened me, what happened to these laborers. So what did you learn about this relationship with China and the United States back in the days when the Transcontinental Railroad was being built, for example?
Yeah, this goes back really to the roots of my family, too, because my family comes from this area of China, of southern China, near Hong Kong, called Taishan County, or Toisan in the local language. And this area is an area that has been the biggest source of Chinese immigration since the 19th century. Starting in the 19th century, when American companies overseas required labor, for example, for the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, they had people in southern China looking for labor, and many people from this county applied. And once some Chinese migrant laborers ended up in the U.S. from this county, Taishan, then they applied for other people to come too. So then every village in this county had people who were working in America or in other Western nations. And my family's village, my father's village, was no different. And we had family members from my great-grandfather's generation who were coming to the U.S. And so these laborers, when they were working in the U.S., they were mostly men, and they would send money back to their home villages. And eventually, I think some of them would go back to China, or they thought about going back to China, but many others had this hope that they could bring their family members over. Then in the late 19th century, the U.S. government, because they're fearful of large numbers of Chinese immigrants entering the U.S., they put forward this Chinese Exclusion Act, which is the very first act or law in the U.S. that bars immigrants from a specific country from coming to the U.S. So it is imposed on the Chinese. These men cannot bring their families over, but they need to keep sending money back to them. So they keep working here in the U.S. They also end up establishing many of the Chinatowns that we've seen today in the United States. And many of them died eventually in the U.S. without their family coming over. Eventually, this Exclusion Act is lifted. And from 1965 or so onward, many Chinese immigrants do come over to the U.S. And some families are reunited.
Might remind listeners that this was during the days when Leland Stanford, a well-known name in California, Leland Stanford was president of the Central Pacific Railroad. So these laborers would come over from this place. I had to look it up. I had never heard of Taishan County. And would you tell listeners, if they aren't familiar with it, where is that in relation to Hong Kong, where your parents met?
Sure. It's very close to Guangzhou, which I mentioned was the is the provincial capital of Guangdong province. It's probably a three-hour drive from Guangzhou. And then from Hong
which
Kong...
Which listeners like might know that Guangzhou by an earlier name, for example, food.
Right, Canton.
Yes.
Canton is what it used to be called. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's also... Taishan County is also several hours away from Hong Kong. But the easiest way to get there is through Guangzhou. And these days, it's a place of rice paddies, villages of stone or concrete houses. But many of the villages are depopulated because the people have started migrating over to the United States, or they've migrated to big cities in China. And so it feels very much like you're going through ghost villages when you're there. I visited it twice. And what's interesting is, for example, on that trip when I went south with my father to visit his high school classmates, I implored him to go with me to his home village, which is called Hot Wall in Cantonese or Hoho in Mandarin Chinese. And he refused to go. He really didn't want to go back to his home village. I thought he would have some nostalgia, some childhood nostalgia for this place where he had grown up. But instead, he really didn't want to go there. He just wanted to spend his time in the big city of Guangzhou and see his classmates. And I came to realize that the village for him represented this very backward aspect of China. It was just these remote farming areas, places of dirt paths, of rice paddies. And also, his childhood there happened during this Japanese occupation of China. So he had also very dark memories of that period too. And so he really didn't want to go back. And it really made me realize that, you know, even if my father had stayed longer in the South rather than going up to the North to join the Chinese army there, he eventually probably would have left also. I don't think he would have stayed in the South. I don't think he would have kept any firm roots in those village areas. I think many Chinese American children, you know, growing up in my generation, thought that, oh, maybe there was this alternative history where their parents never moved abroad and stayed in China and they grew up to be village children or something like that. But in fact, this Taishan County area is very unique because it's a place of migration. It's a place of transnational movement. And so I realized when I made my visits there and when I talked with my father that it was not a place where he would have put down roots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say this county made an imprint on the world, and then also migrants brought home outside influences to this area in southern China.
Right. And one of the most remarkable things I noticed when I made my trips down there were these buildings that were all throughout the county. So every village you went to, you would see these two or three multi-story homes or even these five or six story towers. And they resembled European villas or European towers. So it was almost like going through the Tuscan countryside. I was completely astounded by that. And my parents had never talked about this type of building when we were growing up or when I asked them about it later in my adult life. To them, it was just normal, part of the landscape. But I realized as I learned more about the county, as I talked to people there, as I read up on histories of it, that when Chinese men went abroad and they saw architecture in the West, and then they came back and they had some money or they sent money back to their families, they decided that a display of their wealth and of their cosmopolitanism would be embodied in buildings that they would have erected that would resemble these Western buildings, and particularly medieval European buildings. So I thought that was very striking.
Well, you get a lot of information from an uncle, your dad's older brother, and it's surprising that, I mean, your dad has this long history because he's 91 now, isn't he, your dad?
Yeah, he just turned 92 this year.
Okay, so here's your 92-year-old dad, and your uncle, I think he's 95, Uncle Sam.
Yeah, 96 this year.
Okay.
Which is amazing.
It is amazing. When I first opened your book, I looked at all the photographs first thing, and then as I read more about these people in them, I looked at all the photographs again, like that photograph of your dad crying. And of these two kids, your Uncle Sam and your dad, when they were little boys, they were so cute. I really enjoyed the photographs that you include in your book. So thank you for that, Edward. And I guess thank you for your Uncle Sam.
Yeah, he kept many of the photographs. My dad kept some. And, you know, Sam was important for the writing of this book. He had written a sort of self-published memoir to the story to the family mm-hmm. some decades ago. I, in fact, copy edited that memoir. So I already had imprinted in my head some of the family history that he knew. And then he's been the family historian through the decades. And even now at age 96, he still sends me letters, sends me emails with documents about the family. And he's very sharp. I think he's one of these super agers mm-hmm. who whose mental faculties stay very clear, very sharp, very late into life. So he's been an immense resource.
Well, you mentioned your daughter, Aria. Is that how you pronounce her name?
Aria, yeah. She's 12. She's almost 12. She's 11 now. So.
And it is jaw-dropping that China, we know it's an old country. I mean, that's what some people, that's about all they know about China. But she, your daughter, is the 31st generation of the Wang family. My goodness, the 31st generation of your family. And she is 12 years old now, right?
Didn't you say? That's right. So, yeah, that's right. And on one of my visits to Taishan County, there was this county historian, a historian of the Wang family, in fact, who took me to a building that was the archives of the Wang family. And he showed me this huge tome, almost like this medieval manuscript that had this immense family tree in it. And he pointed out where I was in the family tree. Mm-hmm. He pointed out where my children would go once they were born. And so these family trees are being well documented in China by these family associations.
Well, speaking of relatives too, you have a cousin who's an ambassador, Gary Locke.
He's in Washington State now, and he was the first Chinese American to be Commerce Secretary, and he was Commerce Secretary in the Obama administration. And he also was the first Chinese American to be the governor of Washington State, which I think was his first very high-level political office. And then Obama decided to appoint him ambassador to China in 2011, and he arrived shortly before Vice President Joe Biden made a trip to China.
And you were invited. You were invited when Vice President Biden went to China, Beijing.
Yeah, I was living in Beijing at the time, and I was brought into the traveling press school that was following the vice president around. And that was fascinating because I witnessed the first substantial meeting that Biden had with Xi Jinping, who was then the vice president of China, but is now the leader of China. 2011, mm-hmm. the summer of 2011, was right before Xi took power. He would take power 1 year later, but everyone knew that he was on the path to becoming the top leader in China. And so Obama sent Biden over to China in order to take a measure of Xi, to get to know Xi somewhat, and report back to the White House on what he was seeing and what he was hearing. So I was there present when Biden met with Xi in Beijing, welcomed into the Great Hall of the People on one side of Tiananmen Square. And I was there when the two of them made a trip to Southwest China, where there had been a devastating earthquake in 2008 in mm-hmm. Sichuan Province, and then had these dinners together, had visited a school together, even shot hoops at a basketball court together.
You said how many times it took Biden to get a goal.
Yes, 7 times.
Edward Wang is author of At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is the son of Chinese immigrants, and his book is A Family's Reckoning with China at the Edge of Empire. Well, you mentioned there are five official religions in China. Five official religions: Islam, Taoism, Protestantism, Catholicism, Buddhism. But what did they require for Muslims who wanted to go on a Hajj?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Northwest China in this region called Xinjiang for a couple of reasons. One is my father had been posted there in the Chinese army, and that was where he spent, almost his entire service in the army, a half dozen years. And he was living among the Uyghur Muslims and the Kazakh Muslims. So he had some strong interactions with them and had been part of the initial military occupation of the region. So I was naturally interested in that region. And then when I went to China as a reporter, I kept going back to that region over and over to report on lots of news events that were occurring in the region, ethnic violence, ethnic tensions, also the Communist Party's strict control on religion. And what you're referring to is one of their harshest, you know, forms of control before the more recent era of internment camps. They prevented many of the Uyghur Muslims from taking part in these very important rituals of Islam.
You had to be wealthy? They had to be wealthy because it was expensive.
Yeah, to be wealthy. Even then, it was very difficult to get passport and permission to go on the Hajj to Saudi Arabia. You had to be part of a special group. You had to take these designated flights. Many Uyghur Muslims were not allowed to have passports, and you had to apply to have a passport. And then if you went on the Hajj and came back, they would take that passport back so that you couldn't travel freely outside of China. So the restrictions on the Uyghurs were immense. What I discovered also, and this was even way back in 2008 and earlier, was that, for example, during the fasting month of Ramadan, which is also one of the five pillars of Islam, they would try and ensure that students, teachers, government officials, party members who were Muslims or who are Muslims could not fast or would not fast. This was not allowed if you were in these broad categories of people. And so already very early on, the party was trying to impose very strict controls on the practice of Islam. And that's ramped up in recent years as a million or so of these Uyghur Muslims or Kazakh Muslims have been put into internment camps. They've been forced to put aside many of their practices of Islam. And we hear stories of them being told or compelled to eat pork, for example, in some of the cafeterias in these places. We're told that, again, they can't fast during Ramadan. So now the party is on this much more concentrated, focused effort to really tamp down these Muslim practices among them.
My guest is New York Times correspondent Edward Wong. His book is At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. Now, I mentioned Tibet, that foreign journalists were banned from Tibet, but the Tibetan language is losing out to Mandarin because they are making it practically impossible for Tibetans to learn or to keep up their native language. How do they do that?
Yeah, language is an important theme throughout the book because I realized from my, you know, relations with my parents and from growing up as an immigrant kid and also from my many years of reporting that language is really what keeps you rooted to your identity and to your culture. And the party and Chinese officials, to a certain degree, believe that if they can suppress a person's knowledge of their native or indigenous language, then that person's identity will gravitate towards the culture of the majority Han Chinese people who are in interior China. And so they're doing this with the Tibetans and with the Uyghurs and others. In Tibet, I met Tibetans who really wanted strong bilingual language education in the schools there across the vast region. And instead, the schools are mainly teaching Mandarin to the Tibetan children. There's very little teaching of Tibetan in a real sense. There might be a Tibetan class as if it's a foreign language class, the same way we might learn French in high school where it's taught in a single class, rather than Tibetan being used in instruction in at least half the classes. In America, for example, my daughter is in a bilingual Spanish-English school here in Washington where half her classes are in Spanish. So she gets even stronger instruction in Spanish here in the U.S. than Tibetan children get in Tibetan in their home region in Western China.
And it's sad to me that they can make it a crime for to teach people their own language.
I met a Tibetan businessman, Tashi Wangchuk, and I spent some time with him. I interviewed him about his desire to bring Tibetan language education in a fuller form to his home areas in Tibet on the Tibetan Plateau. He was really advocating for officials to put Tibetan language into schools as a truly bilingual language that was taught alongside Mandarin to the same degree as Mandarin. And instead, once the local government and the officials discovered he was advocating publicly for this, that he was talking with foreign journalists, that he was on video talking with one of my colleagues as a video producer, then they detained him, then put him on trial for inciting separatism, and then put him in prison for 5 years. He had been in prison or detained twice briefly before, but never for this long. And what happened was, he got out of prison a few years ago, and I was no longer in China, but I heard from people who were in touch with him, and they said he immediately went back to trying to advocate for Tibetan language education, which shows how strongly he and other Tibetans feel about this issue.
Yeah, that impressed me, too, that he would do that. Well, we started out, I asked you to read some from your book when you first arrived in Beijing, a warm night in April of 2008. So now I would like to fast forward to 2016 when you have a wife and a little girl. Why did you decide to leave China?
I mean, a lot of things had changed by then. I've been there nearly 9 years. Having a child did change some of my reaction to being in China, because at that time, I think in those years, the air pollution weighed heavily on us. It weighed heavily on us and many Chinese citizens living in these cities as well, because we were very much aware of how poisonous the air was. We knew the air pollution indexes. There were days that we called air apocalypse days, when you could barely see the hand in front of your face because of all the smog that came from burning fossil fuels, burning coal in factories. And I felt that this would have an impact on the health of a young child. Many Chinese parents had the same concerns, and I was lucky because I could leave. I knew, middle class or wealthier Chinese citizens who were also planning to leave China because of this environmental catastrophe that was going on at the time. Also, it became much harder to report in China. Our Chinese reporters, the ones who worked with me in the bureau, they were being questioned much more intensely by security agents. And then when I would talk with sources, in some cases, the police would come up to the sources afterwards, would visit them in their homes, and really grill them on why they had spoken with a foreign reporter. This was much more rare when I first came to China in 2008, but it was starting to become more common in 2016. And it would take place even on stories that I thought were completely harmless and had no political dimension to them. So for example, I interviewed a scientist about melting glaciers in Western China. He took me on a hike around a glacier, and then I went back to Beijing, wrote the story. After it appeared, I heard from the scientist. He said the police had come to him afterwards and asked him why he had spoken to us, asked him in a very disapproving manner. And this really showed me that many things that we thought were not political were being put into the realm of politics under the governance of Xi Jinping, the current leader of China.
So this is all scary, but I think it's really important for us as Americans to understand China today. And that's what I think your book helps us to do, Edward. It helps us understand China today. Is there anything else you want to add just in a couple of words to how your book does that?
I think that just having this family story really helps your average American reader relate to what's going on in China. I think anyone who reads about my father and his dreams and then his disillusionment in China and then his desperate flight to freedom in Hong Kong in the U.S. and then they read about my return to China and my discovery of China today, what it means, where it's going. I think these are all ways in which the average reader can learn about China and learn about it very easily in a very compelling story.
Well, I think it is an important book to help us understand China today. So Edward Wong's book is At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. Edward Wong, xie xie.
Xie, Nancy. Thank you very much.
And now here's Eric Miller.
Hi, Nancy. I have a story for you. This is based on an experience I had at my father's assisted living center. And the title of the story is Hanging Out with Old Attitudes. They are kids with wrinkled skin who wear plenty of attitude. Shuttle vans wait outside the main entrance, moored like ships, their captains biding time until passengers load. Panel doors slide open. Wheelchair ramps unfold. Then they file in, some by wheels and others by foot. The destinations could be anywhere, to a doctor's appointment, a shopping excursion, or perhaps to a movie. But they need chauffeurs these days. Upon reflection, the easy trips taken during their youth were taken for granted. Those youthful mileposts have long since been surpassed. With frail bodies and tired eyes, they rely on others to drive them about. Still, they experience freedom or a semblance of it. After the vans load, the captains launch their ships. Inside, I walk by a greeter who sits across a gym. The gym is supervised by physical and occupational therapists, young 30-somethings coaching and pushing their clientele. Racks of 2-pound dumbbells line the wall. I observe old guys and gals stretching elastic bands and the therapists stretching them. I make my way upstairs to Dad's room. His TV blares at 120 decibels, the same loudness of a thunderclap. His chair perches forward like a pilot's ejection seat. "Let's go to happy hour," he said. "But it's only 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock is when things get going around here." Dad has Parkinson's disease, among other ailments. A cancer survivor, Dad is a U.S. Air Force veteran, Vietnam vet, and veteran of multiple back and neurological surgeries. His mind is sharp, albeit easily distracted. He's ambulatory, but mostly via wheelchair. I pushed him down the hallway towards the dining area. Dad navigated the route. "Go straight and then turn left. You'll find everyone there." Around the table sat 5 ladies, their hair white as snow. Canes leaned on the wall behind them. One gal sat in a wheelchair. 2 had margaritas with mini umbrellas standing in their glasses. I told them I heard they were once cheerleaders. I asked if they could show me the splits. "You're a smart aleck," Agnes said. "Just like your dad. That's why we like him." They asked about me, and I gave them the data dump. Then I asked about them. Midge originally hails from Massachusetts. Florence came from Louisiana. Their husbands had long ago passed away. Agnes grew up in Iowa. "Oh, Iowa," I replied. "Then I'll speak slower so you can understand." Agnes reached for her cane to wallop me. "No," she chuckled. "That would be Bob. He's from Kansas." The ladies laughed and discussed their ailments ranging from sore knees to faulting hearing aids to having to eat kale. Agnes bragged that she had a dinner date that evening with Frank, a retired proctologist. "He's good with his hands, kiddo." Florence noticed that Bob was late for happy hour. "Where's Bob?" Bob arrived 30 minutes early but left to use the bathroom. He misread his watch. Midge sipped her margarita, said she knew her booze. I asked if she heard the story about 3 gals who went into a bar. "Do tell," she exclaimed. 3 gals walk into a bar, a blonde, brunette, and redhead. "I once was a redhead," Florence interjected. "And I once dated a redhead," Midge added. I smiled and continued. The brunette asked for a BL. The bartender said he was unfamiliar with a BL. The brunette responded, "It's a Bud Light, duh." The ladies laughed and leaned into the table, wanting more. "What then?" The redhead tells the bartender she wants a CL. The bartender was confused. What's a CL? The redhead scolded him. A Coors Light, duh. By now, my audience had bit the hook. Tell us about the blonde. What did the blonde order? I smiled, realizing it was time to reel them in. Okay, so now this blonde orders a 14 from the bartender. Stumped, the bartender reviewed his notes. What's a 14? It's a 7 and 7, duh. The ladies howled. Agnes tapped her cane on my chest. Bob will love this joke. We'll tell him, if we can remember it. Our server arrived with a plate of snacks. We then talked about their lives, their kids, their grandkids, their great-grandkids, places they've lived and people they've loved. All appeared flustered with their current physical condition, but all appreciated the camaraderie and fellowship. They genuinely cared for one another. Bob then arrived, bumping his walker into my leg. Sorry about that, he apologized. No worries, sir. I'm Doc's son. What are you in for? He grinned like a convict masking the truth. I'm doing time for a stroke. Been here 3 years. I visited again the next day for a Hawaiian-themed luncheon. I sat next to Bob and asked whether the lady shared my joke. No, he said wistfully. They must have forgotten. Tell me. I repeated the story and Bob laughed. We're all in our twilight years, he said. Hell, my sleep phone mattress has better memory than I do. But we managed to have good attitudes. You should see us on poker night. If we all had 20 bucks, we wouldn't get out of a Chinese whorehouse. Bob's timing and delivery knocked me out of my shoes. I'm fortunate my parents are still alive. Mom is in better health and lives alone but isn't lonesome. Our friends keep us going, she told me. We have financial resources, call each other, and visit on Facebook. Retirement funds and good health aside, I observed one common theme. Attitude is priceless. I'm Eric Miller.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.